I'm Josh Belinfani, president of the Atlanta chapter, would like to welcome you all to our virtual meeting of the Federal Society. We've gone as a board back and forth on folks' preferences in terms of what you'd like to see. I think we've heard two camps. Some people are just zoomed out and some people want to see continued programming. So we'll try to accommodate both as much as we can. Today we have a rescheduled program with former Justice Keith Blackwell, now currently with Alston and Byrd. He is a friend of the Federal Society and a friend to many of you I know, who really needs virtually no introduction. I'll be exceedingly brief so that we can hear from him. As most of you know, Keith graduated top of his class from UGA, both in undergrad and in law school. He clerked for Judge Edmondson on the 11th Circuit. He served in private practice, was a prosecutor in the Cobb County DA's office before being appointed by Governor Perdue to the Court of Appeals, and then by Governor Deal to the Supreme Court of Georgia. Justice Blackwell penned a significant number of cases, many of which changed reinforced a lot of thinking in areas of the Georgia courts, one that I think is cited about as much as any. In fact, I saw 239 times earlier today is Deal versus Coleman, which addresses issues of statutory construction and other issues that has now become standard in Georgia and effectively black letter law, among others. He's joining us today to kind of take a look back at the Supreme Court of Georgia and where it's been since 2010 to 2020 and what changes we've seen. So without further ado, Justice Blackwell, we thank you for participating today and we look forward to your remarks. Oh, one other thing, I'm sorry, before you get started. There is a Q&A button on the bottom for participants. You can certainly go in there and type questions. There will be time for questions at the end. One of the nice things about Zoom is we tend to end earlier and on time, but there will be time for that. And if you submit your question, I will try to get it to Justice Blackwell in time as the presentation ends. So I won't yank the mic back again, Justice Blackwell. Look forward to hearing from you. Thank you again.
Josh, thank you very much. And thanks to the Federalist Society for having me here today, giving me the opportunity to talk about the past decade on the Supreme Court. I was there for 8.5 years of the last decade, and so have a pretty intimate knowledge of the court during that time period. I also want to apologize to any of you who might have signed up for the originally scheduled program. I had a little touch of a stomach virus that was pretty tough, but fortunately pretty short-lived the night before the originally scheduled program, and Josh worked with me to reschedule that. With that, let me begin my presentation, and I'm going to work through a few aspects of the court during the last decade, a few observations, and I've got a PowerPoint I'm going to share with you while I talk. So first, I want to walk through kind of the workload at the court, what that is like. Then I want to talk a little bit about changes that we saw at the court, both in terms of workload and institutional practices during my time at the court. Then I want to talk a little bit about some of the jurisprudential trends at the court over the last decade. So let's start with workload. A lot of folks asked me what surprised me most when I went from the Court of Appeals to the Supreme Court, and it was probably the extent of the administrative portion of the workload at the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court obviously has adjudicative responsibilities of deciding cases, but the Supreme Court also has immense administrative responsibilities. And a lot of you may be familiar with at least some of those administrative responsibilities, but maybe not the full breadth of those administrative responsibilities. And I found during my time on the court that those administrative responsibilities consumed about 15 to 20% of a justice's time, so a pretty substantial portion of the workload at the court is administrative in nature. That administrative workload includes the court's regulation of the practice of law, which includes the court is responsible for promulgating the rules of professional conduct, The court reviews formal advisory opinions on those rules issued by the State Bar of Georgia. The court actually supervises and exercises oversight over the State Bar itself, which was created by order of the court and is an administrative arm of the court for purposes of regulating the practice of law. The court also has some other responsibilities in this space, including the Chief Justice's Commission on Professionalism. In addition to regulating the practice of law, the court also regulates entry into the practice of law in Georgia, which includes the rules for admission, whether that's admission on examination or admission by motion. It includes the oversight of the Board of Bar Examiners, oversight of the board to determine the fitness and character of bar applicants, and the Office of Bar Admissions, which is the administrative office that gives support to both of those boards. The court is also responsible for regulation of the judiciary. The court promulgates the Code of Judicial Conduct. During my time on the court, there was actually a wholesale revision of the Code of Judicial Conduct, and we signed off on a completely revised code. The court also reviews formal advisory opinions coming up from the Judicial Qualifications Commission. And although the JQC is not a subordinate body to the court, it is an independent body. Notwithstanding that, the court appoints more members of the JQC than any other appointing authority, and the court, therefore, is intimately involved in the management of the JQC. Then, in addition to all that, the court also, as the highest court in Georgia, has responsibilities for the supervision of the judicial branch. That includes the making of uniform rules of court for all classes of court, rules for alternative dispute resolution, regulation of court reporters, regulation of court interpreters. The Chief Justice serves as the chair of Judicial Council, which is the policymaking body in which all classes of court are represented that makes policy for the judicial branch. In his role as chair of the Judicial Council and also the court independently of Judicial Council exercises oversight over the administrative office of the courts, which supplies a lot of back office functions for numerous classes of courts. And then as we have learned in the past year or so, the Chief Justice and the Supreme Court have a number of powers in the context of a judicial emergency that has certainly have come into play in the middle of COVID. Now, in addition to the administrative workload of the court, we also have the caseload. To begin, the caseload of the Supreme Court is very, very heavy, kind of in absolute terms. There was a governor-appointed commission in 2016, the Appellate Jurisdiction Review Commission. Justice Namias and I served on it on behalf of the Supreme Court. Judge Sarah Doyle and Judge Stephen Dillard from the Court of Appeals served on it, as well as a number of practitioners and legislators who served on this commission to review the caseload and jurisdiction of both of the appellate courts. And what the commission found as of 2016 was that the Supreme Court indeed had a very high caseload. They calculated that on average, the Supreme Court every year was deciding about 432 cases by opinion. And that amounts to, at that time we had seven justices, that amounted to almost 62 opinions per year per justice. By comparison, the U.S. Supreme Court disposes of roughly 75 cases a year, and they have nine justices. So they're writing about a little more than eight opinions on average per justice per year. So the court, in terms of published opinions, has a very high caseload. And of course, published opinions only represents a portion of the court's docket because the court also has a number of matters that it resolves by unpublished order, including all the cert petitions that aren't granted, all the applications to appeal in habeas cases, as well as numerous other applications to appeal and motions that the court has to hear. Not only is the caseload of the court high in absolute terms, it is high relative to that of courts of last resort in other states. Now, there aren't a lot of comparative studies, because it's difficult to do comparative studies from one state to another, given all the differences in appellate procedure from state to state. But there have been a couple of attempts to do comparative caseload analyses across multiple states. And in 2008, the University of Chicago published a study that looked at all 50 states and concluded that the Georgia Supreme Court was the single most productive high court in the country. Similarly, there was a study commissioned by the Massachusetts Supreme Judicial Court in 2017 that didn't look at all 50 states, but looked at all the largest states and similarly concluded that the Georgia Supreme Court was the most productive court of last resort among all the state high courts that they looked at. Not only does the court have a very high volume caseload, both in absolute and relative terms, but the court also has to dispose of that caseload under very unique time constraints. We have a constitutional provision in Georgia that some of you may be familiar with. It's known as the two-term rule or the distress rule. That says the Supreme Court and the Court of Appeals shall dispose of every case either at the term for which it is docketed or at the next term. So the court and the Court of Appeals get two terms to decide every case. The courts have three terms of court a year. Each term is roughly about 4 months, but there is a hard and definitive limit on the time in which the court can decide a case. As far as we can tell, the Georgia appellate courts are unique in that regard. There are a lot of other appellate courts in other states and even some federal courts that have aspirational goals, but that do not have hard deadlines by which cases must be decided. So why is the caseload at the court so high? Well, let's look next at the jurisdiction of the court as it was framed under the Constitution of 1983. Under the Constitution of 1983, the Supreme Court had jurisdiction in several classes of cases. First of all, direct appeals of certain civil cases that would not go from the trial court to the Court of Appeals, but instead would pass over the Court of Appeals and go directly from the trial court to the Supreme Court. Those included civil cases presenting novel constitutional questions, election contests, and cases of equity, cases involving extraordinary remedies, cases involving title to land, cases involving wills, and divorce and alimony cases. The court also has direct appellate jurisdiction in a number of criminal cases that, again, will pass over the Court of Appeals and come directly to the Supreme Court. Those include criminal cases that present novel constitutional questions, murder cases, all murder cases, and habeas cases. In addition to that, the court has a docket of regulatory cases, which includes lawyer discipline matters, judicial discipline matters, and rarely, but occasionally, disputes that arise out of the bar admissions process. The court also has jurisdiction to receive and answer certified questions from the U.S. Supreme Court, the federal circuit courts, the federal district courts, any state appellate court, or from our own Court of Appeals. In addition, the court, like most high courts in states in which there is an intermediate appellate court, has the power to review decisions of the Court of Appeals by writ of certiorari. And in addition to that, there's one more class of cases that may come up from the Court of Appeals other than by certiorari. Those are rare, but it happened at least a couple of times during my time at the court. And those are what we call equal division cases, cases that were within the direct appellate jurisdiction of the Court of Appeals, but on which the Court of Appeals judges equally divided. And essentially, it was a tie in the Court of Appeals. Those are transferred automatically to the Supreme Court for resolution. Now, the heavy caseload caused some concern at the court and among practitioners. There were a number of concerns. One was that the court was reaching its workload capacity. The court, the justices of the court are very hardworking. Their staff is very hardworking. I can assure you of that after spending 8.5 years there. The caseload and the administrative workload were reaching the point where the court could not do much more. At the same time, there was a lot of concern, especially in the civil litigation bar, that the court was not frequently enough granting cert to review decisions coming out of the Court of Appeals. In addition, the Court of Appeals caseload continued to grow. The Court of Appeals was putting out more and more cases every year. Even if you assume that only 10% of those deserve review in the Supreme Court, the number of cases in absolute terms would grow over time that would need to be reviewed. But the court really was at least approaching a point where it could not in good conscience grant many more certs than it was granting because of all the things that came directly to the Supreme Court. They didn't have any choice in whether to take or not, all those direct appeals we talked about. Fortunately, the Constitution of 1983 left room for the General Assembly to help. And that was because some categories of cases assigned to the Supreme Court under the Constitution of 1983, the Constitution actually said that the Supreme Court would have appellate jurisdiction of those cases unless otherwise provided by law. And those cases were the equity cases, the cases involving extraordinary remedies, cases involving title to land, cases involving wills, divorce and alimony, murder cases, and habeas corpus cases. So the Appellate Jurisdiction Reform Commission looked at it and made a recommendation to the governor and the General Assembly in 2016 that the civil direct appeals that are now in red on the slide, equity cases, extraordinary remedies, title to land, wills, and divorce and alimony, that those be transferred by statute to the Court of Appeals. That represented at the time roughly about 20% of the court's docket. And so the thought was that would give the Supreme Court considerable relief in terms of caseload with the idea that perhaps the Supreme Court could start taking on more cert cases. The General Assembly and the governor accepted those recommendations and in 2016 enacted the Appellate Jurisdiction Reform Act. Two key provisions I want to mention. One did exactly what I was talking about in terms of appellate jurisdiction and sent those categories of direct appeals with a couple of minor exceptions for equity or extraordinary remedy cases that might have a bearing on murder cases, sent all those cases in the first instance to the Court of Appeals. And then, of course, the losing party at the Court of Appeals could apply for review by certiorari in the Supreme Court. One reason that the commission did not recommend and the General Assembly did not also transfer the murder and habeas cases was that the Court of Appeals in 2015 had just added three new judges, one new division of the Court of Appeals. So they went from 12 judges to 15, and they actually had a little excess capacity at that point in time. They had enough capacity to take on all of those direct civil appeals, but if murder cases and habeas cases had been moved to the Court of Appeals, it would have required the addition of yet another panel of judges to the Court of Appeals. Notwithstanding that, the thought was that perhaps in 20 or 30 years, the legislature would need to revisit murder cases as the state's population grew and the number of murders, even if the crime rate didn't increase, the number of murders would grow with population growth. And so at some point, consideration would have to be given to taking the murder cases off the Supreme Court's plate. The other significant change in the Appellate Jurisdiction Reform Act, of course, was increasing the size of the court from 7 to 9 justices. So were the goals of the Appellate Jurisdiction Reform Act met? Well, let's look next at the caseload of the court and how it changed in the years following the Reform Act. So we're looking now at decisions by published opinion in certain categories from 2016 to 2020. And let's look first at the regulatory cases, the lawyer discipline cases, judicial discipline, and bar admissions matters. Those were unaffected by the Appellate Jurisdiction Reform Act. You would expect them to remain fairly constant. And indeed, that's what you see. They remain fairly constant. There is a slight drop off in 2019, a pretty substantial drop off by 2020, I'm not frankly sure what the reasons are for that. I suspect that in 2020, the drop-off is because these cases tend to move from the regulatory proceedings to the Supreme Court fairly quickly, much more quickly than appeals from trial courts. And because of the COVID shutdown, a lot of proceedings in the state bar and perhaps with the JQC were put on hold or delayed. And so those cases, which you would expect to have arrived in the court during the same year, were not in fact arriving. So you see some drop off. I expect when COVID subsides that those numbers will creep back up probably to about the level that we saw from 2016 to 2018. The next category is the direct appeals in civil cases. There you see the substantial drop off you would expect. 72 direct appeals in civil cases in 2016, slightly more in 2017. That's because the effective date of the legislation was January 1st, 2017, and it did not apply to cases already docketed. So cases already docketed in the Supreme Court by the end of 2016 would be held by the Supreme Court for decision in 2017. And it was only newly docketed cases that would follow the new jurisdictional rules. So you see the drop off, you would expect to see it in 2018. That's exactly what you see. Once the jurisdiction over direct appeals in civil cases is cut down to only civil cases presenting novel constitutional questions or involving election contests, the number drops from 78 pretty dramatically to 18. Falls even further. Last year, the court only had 9 cases. Therefore, the court has excess capacity. You would expect to see the number of certs go up. So let's look now at the combined number of certs and certified questions. Surprisingly, you don't see any increase at all. In fact, 2016 was the high watermark for the court hearing certs and certified questions. But that portion of the docket has remained pretty flat. So why? Has the court just kind of gotten lazy? Well, that's not the case at all when we look at the next category of cases. Murder cases unexpectedly skyrocketed after 2016. You see that the court decided 163 murder cases by published opinion in 2016. That's roughly consistent with what the average had been for the preceding 5 years. You see it step up substantially in 2017 to 180, then step up a lot more in 2019 and 2020. Last year, the court decided 244 murder cases by published opinion. Now, that leads to a number of concerns. Let's look at the difference in kind of what the overall docket looked like in 2016 and what it looked like in 2020. As you can see in 2016, again, this is the published opinions docket, roughly half of the court's docket is criminal, leaving the other half for regulatory and civil. Now, of course, the granted certs do include some criminal cases, but civil granted certs always outnumber criminal granted certs pretty substantially. The lion's share of those and all the certified questions are in civil cases. So the majority of that portion of the pie we're looking at are civil matters. So you can look, there's some balance in 2016 between criminal on the one hand and civil and regulatory on the other, which is exactly what you would want in a high court. Let's look at what it looks like now in 2020. As you can see, the murder cases have grown so substantially, some of the other categories of cases have either remained flat or have shrunk over time, so that 3/4 of the cases the court is deciding now by published opinion are criminal cases, and the vast majority of those are murder cases. I think that causes a number of concerns. One is that we again will soon be reaching the point where the court is at capacity, and the direct appeals in murder cases will start squeezing the court's capacity to grant certs. The court certainly, I think, probably wishes, I know I did before I left, that we could spend more time working on the really hard cases, which tend to be the certified questions and granted certs, rather than murder cases, which sometimes involve really complicated and difficult issues, but much more commonly present only routine issues. of evidence and Fourth Amendment law and ineffective assistance of counsel and so forth. I think another real problem is that to the extent this puts a hard cap on the extent to which the court can review Court of Appeals decisions by cert, it effectively makes the Court of Appeals a court of last resort in many civil cases. And there also, I think, is some danger in over time the Supreme Court justices becoming too specialized in murder cases. I'm not sure that benefits the court's consideration of difficult civil and constitutional and regulatory matters in the long run. So I don't think the court's at the breaking point yet, but this is something that if this trend continues, there are some reasons to think it will. There are a couple reasons to think maybe part of the increase at least is a temporary bubble. But if this trend continues long-term, I think it's going to be incumbent on a lot of folks in this virtual room and a lot of members of the bar to take some leadership and encourage the General Assembly to look at ways to alleviate the Supreme Court's murder docket. Now, let's talk about the other change that was worked by the Jurisdiction Reform Act, which was the composition of the court. The composition of the court, of course, went from 7 to 9. And you have personnel changes throughout the decade that also impacted the composition of the court. What did the 7 to 9 accomplish? Well, I will tell you, it gave the court some help on its adjudicative capacity in terms of handling its caseload. It did reduce per justice writing responsibility by about 20% when you went from the cases being divided for writing among 7 justices to being divided among 9. That was certainly some help. But the impact on adjudicative capacity was really limited by the fact that the court decides everything in bank as a whole court. And so regardless of whether you have 7 or 9 or 15 justices, every justice has to read the briefs, review the pertinent parts of the record, and vote on and help decide every single case, regardless of who's writing. So the impact on caseload, there was some impact, but it was limited. There was a tremendous impact, though, on the court's ability to discharge its administrative responsibilities, because for the first time, the court handles a lot of those administrative responsibilities by the appointment of liaison justices. And for a long time, regardless of the scope of the administrative assignment, there was really only one liaison justice for each of those administrative assignments that fell within the scope of the court's administrative responsibilities. A few of those are tremendous responsibilities, including the state bar justice and the bar admissions justice. After the change and after the addition of 2 new justices, the court was able to double up on administrative assignments to the most work-intensive administrative roles. And so after that, for instance, on bar admissions and on the state bar, the liaison justices were myself and Justice Nels Peterson. And I can tell you, having worked on state bar matters even before the expansion from 7 to 9 and having briefly been the liaison justice before that change, the workload was far more manageable with 2 justices. So that was a tremendous help to the court. Some other ways in which the composition of the court changed and it really affected the culture or work of the court was the court got substantially younger over time. Governor Perdue and Governor Deal and Governor Kemp tended to appoint younger justices than maybe historically had been appointed. Although past governors had appointed younger justices as well, occasionally, including Justice Leah Sears, who was very young when she went on the court. But I think the median age came down a lot during the last decade at the court. That meant the court was, first of all, more tech savvy, which increased its efficiency, better enabled the justices to work remotely, which became of tremendous value once COVID hit, and a lot of us were working remotely and, in fact, hearing oral arguments remotely. Another change at the court was you increasingly saw the court populated by veterans of the Court of Appeals. When I arrived at the court in 2012, two of the seven, myself and Justice Benham, had served on the Court of Appeals. In 2019, six of the nine justices had previous service on the Court of Appeals, which, given the importance of the court's certiorari work, I think is of considerable help and considerable importance to the Supreme Court. I will also just observe that over the near decade that I served on the court, I observed the court become a lot more collaborative in writing opinions. It is extremely collaborative. For those of you who don't know, an opinion is assigned to a particular justice, but there is a lot of feedback on every draft of an opinion that comes around. There is a lot of collaboration. There is a lot of collaborative work to improve that opinion. I know I probably have an opinion out there that I wrote that has contributions from every single other justice with whom I serve, and probably every other justice with whom I served has opinions out there that include some footnote that I wrote and asked them to include, or some paragraph that I asked them to include, or something that I asked them to omit. I saw the court become increasingly collaborative as you had more and more justices who were very active in spending a lot of time on other justices' opinions and then suggesting or sometimes insisting on edits or changes to those opinions. Another change you see over time is that the court, I think, at oral argument became much more active, a lot more questions, a much hotter bench than you had ever seen before. And I think that was a real change. In addition to that, you have a few other institutional changes at the court during that decade, and I'll try to move through these fairly quickly. In 2016, you had a rule change regarding the procedure for the recusal of a justice. The traditional practice at courts of last resort had been that when there was a motion to recuse a justice, the justice decided for himself or herself whether to recuse. After the Caperton decision came down from the U.S. Supreme Court and a new procedure was adopted in the trial courts of Georgia for the judge who is the subject of a motion to recuse to refer that motion to another judge to decide the recusal question, the Supreme Court briefly adopted that practice and went to a procedure where if there was a motion to recuse me, it would come to me first. If I didn't agree to voluntarily recuse, I would be required to refer the motion to the other then six members of the court, and they, without my participation, would decide the recusal question. That became a problem in one case that I recall where there was a motion to recuse everyone on the court except myself and Justice Namias. And so we were in the very unusual position of asking all the other justices to step out of the room and then the two most junior justices deciding whether the others could participate. We thought they could participate. They did participate in that case. But that caused us to think that perhaps if you someday had a court where justices were interested in gamesmanship, that you could have some real problems with recusal motions by empowering one justice to force another off of a case. We also looked around the country at some other courts of last resort that had run into real problems and gotten into very vicious and sometimes very publicly vicious fights about whether to force the disqualification of a colleague. So in 2016, the court decided to revert to the longstanding and traditional practice where each justice decides for himself or herself whether to recuse. In 2018, there was another big change when the General Assembly appropriated funds for hiring term clerks. Historically, the Supreme Court justices had law clerks who were career clerks, and they had two of them. But in 2018, the General Assembly authorized a third law clerk to be a temporary employee, a law clerk hired for a term of 1 year, much like the federal appellate courts do. That not only increased the in-chambers workload capacity for each justice, but it also gave the justices an opportunity to mentor younger lawyers. Typically, term clerks come directly or soon after graduating law school and gave them the opportunity to mentor those folks and also promised the bar that at some point there would be ambassadors of the court in the practicing bar, former term clerks who really understood in a very intimate way how the court worked. And I think that's good for the court and good for the bar. In 2018, the court also discontinued its practice of bringing a court of appeals or superior court judge on as a designated judge whenever a justice was recused, and instead moved to a rule where a designated judge would be brought in to replace a recused justice only if that were needed to achieve a quorum or if a majority of the justices still participating thought it was advisable. There were also some changes, internal changes to the court calendar in 2019 that made a big difference in the ability of the justices to carry their workload. All the oral arguments, rather than being spread out over a month, all the oral arguments for a month were collapsed into a single week. The court typically then has 2 weeks a month where it meets in bank to consider cases, and that freed up a fourth week each month for the justices to devote to administrative responsibilities, research, and writing. Which was much needed. We also saw in 2019 the opening of the Nathan Deal Judicial Center, which was a huge improvement in facilities for the Supreme Court and the Court of Appeals. We saw some changes in briefing requirements and some changes in oral argument practices in 2019 that were largely designed to deal with some problems the court had seen. I don't want us to run out of time, so I'm going to kind of skip past those for now, and let's talk a little bit about jurisprudential trends. One thing you saw was an absolute commitment in the last 10 years by the Supreme Court to textualism. There has long been a struggle in Georgia jurisprudence between textualism, those who think that a legal text ought to be interpreted based only on the text, and those who think that the spirit and reason of legislation or constitutional provisions ought to be taken into account in interpreting those. The prevalent view, I would say, in the decade preceding 2010, although it wasn't universal, it varied somewhat from justice to justice, but I think the dominant view was the view that was captured in the 1960 case, New Amsterdam Casualty, where the court said, our function is to find the legislative intent, to give effect to the intention of the legislature. Courts are not controlled by the literal meaning of the language of the statute, but the spirit or intention of the law prevails over the letter thereof. That started to change in 2010. Justice Namias had arrived at the court in 2009, and in 2010, he issued a special concurrence in a case called Merritt versus State, where he took on the spirit and reason approach pretty directly and said statutes have to be read naturally, they have to be read reasonably, they have to be read in context. But when you start talking about not the meaning of the words as they were written and in the context in which they appear, but instead the unexpressed spirit or reason of legislation, you are venturing into very problematic territory. That was a solo special concurrence by Justice Namias in 2010. But in a sign of how quickly things can change, by 2013, Josh mentioned in the introduction that I wrote a case called Deal versus Coleman. And in Deal versus Coleman, we laid down a definitive standard for statutory interpretation in Georgia. And it was a purely textualist approach. We presumed that the General Assembly meant what it said and said what it meant. We have to afford the statutory text its plain and ordinary meaning. We read it in the same way that ordinary speakers of the English language would. And we consider it in the context in which it appears. And if that reading is plain, then our search for statutory meaning as it is at an end, irrespective of any thoughts about spirit or reason of the legislation. That was a unanimous opinion by the court in 2013. We had progressed a couple of years later in another decision I wrote, Chan versus Ellis, majority decision, unanimous majority decision. The court said explicitly, a statute draws its meaning from its text. That commitment to textualism extended beyond statutes to constitutional interpretation, to the interpretation of court rules, to the interpretation of agency regulations. As Justice Peterson wrote in a case called City of Guyton in 2019, the textualist rules of interpretation apply to all positive legal rules. And so, indeed, as Justice Elena Kagan said, we're all textualists now in Georgia. The textualism that the court committed to was an originalist textualism. Again, starting with Justice Namias in 2010, although there certainly are originalist decisions throughout the history of the court, but there are also non-originalist decisions throughout the history of the court. But in 2010, Justice Namias again writes a concurring opinion in Smith versus Baptiste, where he makes clear his view that our task in interpreting the Constitution is to determine the meaning of the language used in that document, that's the textualist part, and what it would have meant to the people who adopted it as the controlling law for the state. That's the originalist part. 4 years later, in a majority opinion authored by Justice Hugh Thompson, the court said, in construing statutory text, we look to the ordinary meaning of those words at the time the General Assembly enacted the statute. That kind of marked a revival of originalist textualism in Georgia that pretty soon was embraced by pretty much all of the court. In 2017, in the Georgia Motor Trucking Association, Justice Peterson made clear that this originalist textualism applied to constitutional interpretation and said pretty explicitly, a constitutional provision means now what it meant at the time it was enacted. And he clarified a couple years later in Elliott versus State, which I would add, if you haven't read that, it is a masterpiece written by Justice Peterson on constitutional interpretation. He said, we interpret the Georgia Constitution according to its original public meaning. Now, context is very important in the originalist textualism the court developed. As we explain in a decision I wrote called May versus State, we always have to look at context. It's a primary determinant of meaning. You can't read a statutory provision in isolation without regard to its context. And the context you consider is actually pretty broad. It includes other provisions of the same statute other than the one that's at issue, the structure and history of the whole statute, and very importantly, the other law, whether it's constitutional, statutory, or common law, that is in the background of the statutory provision in question. As a result of this, the court has identified a lot of resources in its case law that you can use to assess text and context in an originalist and textualist way. That includes contemporaneous dictionaries. That's very important. If you are trying to define a term that appeared in a statute enacted in 1915, you don't look at a 2020 dictionary because the meaning of word drift over time. Instead, you look at a roughly contemporaneous dictionary. You also sometimes can look at the rules of grammar. You don't want to put too much weight on that, but you can look at the rules of grammar. Corpus linguistics is a tool that the court has not fully embraced, but we've seen the Georgia court has not had the opportunity to embrace, I should say. But I think there probably is some openness to that. We've seen a couple of other courts around the country tap into corpus linguistics as a tool for determining the meaning of words used in statutes. You look at statutory structure, you look at statutory history, meaning the progression, the multiple versions of the statute that were in effect over time preceding the current version of the statute that's at issue. You look at background constitutional law, background statutory law, background common law, background regulatory law, but all as of the time of enactment. That's the originalist piece. That sometimes requires a time machine approach. Again, if you're trying to construe a statute from 1915 and you want to look at that background law, you really have to kind of get in a time machine, if you will, and go back and create the entire state of the law in that area as it existed in 1915, and then take a look at that and how the statute in question fit into that background. You also may look at legislative history. We don't tend to have a lot of legislative history in Georgia. There are circumstances in which you can look at it, but you have to look at it very cautiously. You don't look at it for subjective indications of legislative intent, because legislative intent really doesn't matter at the end of the day. Instead, you look at it to see examples of how people might have construed these words roughly contemporaneous with the enactment of the statute. You also can look at contemporaneous statutory commentary, not after the fact commentary. You can look at the source of statutory language that's borrowed from some other jurisdiction or some other statute. And you also, as the court explained in the DeKalb School Board case, you can look at legislative enactment shortly after the enactment of a constitutional provision or statute in question, because it at least reflects perhaps the legislature's view of that provision. I mentioned again Elliott v. State, you should read it. In that, Justice Peterson deals very eloquently and very well with a special problem the Georgia court has that the U.S. Supreme Court does not have, which is how do you do originalism when you've had 10 constitutions? It's a very complex problem. He works through it very well, and Elliot, I commend it to your reading. Let's talk a little bit about one final issue, which is the court's treatment of precedent and the doctrine of stare decisis. And let's look first at before 2010. Before 2010, specifically in the decade before 2010, when you review the caseload, you see that when the Supreme Court overruled precedent, as it did at about the same rate the court did from 2010 to 2020. But during that period, before 2010, the court usually did so without any or much discussion of stare decisis at all. In fact, most of the cases overruling precedent don't discuss stare decisis at all. Furthermore, it's a little difficult to get a good count on how much precedent was overruled because during that period, the court was notoriously imprecise about the scope of overruling. When it overruled precedent, it often did so in fairly vague terms. An example of that is Garza versus State, where the court overturned about three decades of kidnapping law in Georgia, where the court said, indeed, though stability and certainty in law are desirable, when a majority of the court decides that it must be otherwise to give way to justice, then justice prevails. That was kind of the view of the court towards stare decisis during that period. And in that case, what did the court do? The court said, to the extent prior case law is inconsistent with this approach laid out in Garza, those cases are hereby overruled without identifying the particular cases overruled, which does lead to some uncertainty in the law. In 2010, an opinion that Justice Nomius writes signals a more disciplined approach to stare decisis, adopting the federal standard for stare decisis with the consideration of the four now familiar factors for assessing whether stare decisis warrants keeping a precedent that may be incorrect. At first, the court was uneven in its application of that new Jackson standard. And to tell you the truth, it probably depended on who was writing the opinion. When you look back over the case law, a lot of opinions written during the first few years after Jackson by the newer justices on the court tended to go through the Jackson analysis. In cases written by people who had served on the court for long before Jackson, they tended to not explicitly go through the Jackson factors, although sometimes Justice Nomius would write a concurrence that laid out the Jackson case for overruling a particular precedent during that period. But over time, certainly by halfway through the decade, by around 2015 or 2016, pretty much the entire court had subscribed to Jackson. Today, when the court reconsiders precedents, does it very explicitly. It almost always goes through a thorough treatment of stare decisis under the Jackson standard. And it usually is, not always, but usually is more precise about exactly what's being overruled. So the current approach to precedent and stare decisis, there are a few additional rules that the court has laid down over the past 10 years. One is, what do you do with conflicting precedent? In an opinion written by Justice Melton called White versus State, the court explained that when a lawyer has or a trial judge has conflicting precedents of the Court of Appeals, it is the oldest precedent that controls. When precedents of the Supreme Court conflict, however, it is the most recent precedent that controls. That's pretty much the standard view around the country. Read White versus State if you want to find out why. But that is pretty much the standard view, and Georgia has now made that explicit in the White case. The Georgia court also made clear that stare decisis has little to no application on questions of federal constitutional law. When the Georgia Supreme Court has decided a question of federal constitutional law, but there is a subsequent decision by the U.S. Supreme Court that points in a different direction on that question of federal constitutional law, the obligation of the Georgia Supreme Court is as an act of obedience to follow the U.S. Supreme Court decision. One can imagine that after Brown versus Board of Education, some in Georgia might have said, well, we already have decisions of the Georgia Supreme Court adopting separate but equal, and hey, stare decisis. That doesn't quite work because stare decisis does not offer any protection to precedents of federal constitutional law when the U.S. Supreme Court has gone another way. Stare decisis applies, but less strongly to questions that generally decide constitutional questions, specifically the state constitution. Stare decisis applies more strongly to precedents that decide statutory questions. Stare decisis generally does not apply in the Supreme Court to decisions of the Court of Appeals. So the question is the Supreme Court more frequently overruling precedents? It's difficult to count because of some of the imprecision, but I don't think so. I reviewed every case overruling precedents from 2001 to 2020, and I actually counted more cases in the 2001 to 2010 period than the 2010 to 2020 period overruling precedents. I know there are some in the bar who think that the court has gone too far in overruling precedents in recent years. I don't think it's a problem more frequently. You can always debate in a particular case whether a particular precedent should be overruled, but I think the court is actually overruling less or at roughly the same rate that it had in the past. I think the reason it may draw more attention is because the court is now very explicit about what it's overruling and very explicit about a stare decisis analysis when it does overrule. So a few final observations that I will close with. Practice has, before the Supreme Court, I think has become in some ways more complicated. I will tell you, it is very, very difficult, and I have seen very few lawyers who successfully can do a thorough originalist textualist analysis of old constitutional provisions or old statutes. It's a very, very complicated thing to do. You have to have studied originalism and textualism to a significant degree to be able to do it well, I think. That was my experience on the court. But now I guess I'll try my hand at it, being back in private practice and trying to help clients with appeals and cases in trial courts that are likely to end up on appeal, presenting some of those difficult issues. I enjoyed my time on the court. Ultimately, financial considerations with three girls in college forced me to return to private practice. I will say, for the benefit of my former colleagues who are still on the bench, if you have the opportunity to speak to anyone about it, our appellate judges in Georgia are underpaid. They don't get annual cost of living increases. They only get those when the legislature allows. And I looked the other day, Harold Melton went on the court in 2005. Everybody knows he's leaving in July. And when I looked at it, he has lost $30,000 in purchasing power when you adjust for inflation from what his salary was when he went on the bench in 2005. You see diminishing returns every year. The increases the justices have gotten have not kept up with inflation at all. I was down in real dollar terms about $20,000 when I stepped off the bench. If we want to continue to get quality people on the court, that's going to have to change. So with that, I'd be happy to take any questions anybody has.
Thank you, Justice Blackwell. Appreciate that and your remarks. We've had several questions. I'll try to weed through some because I realize we're on a little bit of limited time, but one kind of goes to issues you've raised in terms of both Elliott and how the court is deciding things now. Are you seeing an increase, or did you see an increase in cases brought under the Georgia Constitution versus federal constitutional claims in Georgia courts?
I think you're certainly starting to see that since the Olvick decision and since the Elliott decision. We had a number of cases around the midpoint of the decade where people started to bring those cases, but they really weren't making a case based on text and context and statute and constitutional structure to distinguish kind of parallel provisions of the Georgia Constitution from the U.S. Constitution. They would raise both, but we didn't see an effort to really develop in the briefing or in the arguments a case for the Georgia Constitution being broader in that respect than the U.S. Constitution. So in a lot of cases, the court said, we're not going to engage in that analysis in the first instance. The parties really haven't made the case, so we're going to assume for purposes of this case that the two provisions are coextensive. But you started seeing people make that case really with Olvick and then with Elliott and post-Elliott, and I think you are increasingly seeing that. I know there was a case involving the regulation of lactation consultants in the last couple of years that the court decided that involved some state constitutional questions. I think another area of state constitutional law that is tremendously underdeveloped is the Baby Ninth Amendment in Georgia, which says that kind of the rights enumerated in the state constitution are not exclusive of, are not the only rights the constitution protects, but it also protects unenumerated rights heretofore recognized. That first came into the constitution in the 1870s or 1880s. And so I think unlike the US Ninth Amendment, which I think the US Supreme Court is very hesitant to get into the Ninth Amendment of the federal constitution because it's so open-ended and in some ways could lead to judges just deciding what rights they think ought to be protected under it. Georgia's has a temporal lockout, which is heretofore recognized means rights that were settled and recognized as of the time the Baby Ninth Amendment first appeared in the Georgia Constitution, late part of the 19th century. So if you look back at what rights were well settled as a matter of common law and were kind of fundamental to our society as of that point in time, I think there's actually some promise in Georgia for having those constitutionally protected under the Baby Ninth.
Great. Another question looked to some of our neighboring states and talking about caseload, and particularly as we saw the numbers on the murder cases, where they have separate courts of appeals for civil and criminal. Have you given any thought to that? Do you have an opinion about that? I've not been aware of that being even raised at the legislature much, but didn't know if you had any thoughts on it.
This is, I have thought about it some. I do think the Court of Appeals is almost but not quite at kind of the maximum desirable number for an intermediate appellate court. We have seen how dysfunctional the bank and how uncertain the case law can become when a appellate court grows as large as, say, the Ninth Circuit. It becomes a real problem. Georgia Court of Appeals currently has 15. I think, and this is a little bit arbitrary, I think they probably could move to 18 pretty safely. I would be worried if they move beyond 18 and would start to think at that point about how to divide the work of the Court of Appeals. You could do it geographically the way Texas and Florida have done, but that doesn't work so well in Georgia because in Florida and Texas, you have multiple large cities, Houston, Dallas, San Antonio, that can anchor those districts. In Florida, Miami, Tampa, Orlando, Jacksonville, that can anchor those districts. In Georgia, to be fair, you have Atlanta and you have the rest of the state. And so what you'd end up with is an Atlanta division of the Court of Appeals and then an everything else division. So I think the more sensible way to do it is civil and criminal. But there's a real downside to that. There are some laws and bodies of law that have to apply and should apply the same in both civil and criminal cases. Most notably, the rules of evidence ought to have the same construction in both contexts. You have some worry about divergence of that law if you have a separate court of civil appeals and separate court of criminal appeals. But of course, the Supreme Court could, I think, manage that through cert if it had adequate capacity.
Got it. I think for the last question we had is, not asking to reveal anything, but you have a successor and there'll soon be a new justice on the Supreme Court at some point in time. What advice would you give to someone coming on to the Supreme Court of Georgia or the Court of Appeals of Georgia, for that matter, if it would even be different?
You know, it depends a lot on where they're coming from. I will tell you, I thought the best preparation for me in going on an appellate court was having been an appellate law clerk. I think there are a variety of experiences that can help prepare you to be an appellate judge. And I don't think it's essential that you have clerked on an appellate court, but having clerked for a year on the 11th Circuit, first day I showed up at the Court of Appeals, I kind of knew what to do. I think being a trial judge can be good preparation for being an appellate judge, but there's a very, very important difference, a couple of important differences. One is you are not bound by precedent to the same extent you are as a trial judge when you're a Court of Appeals judge or a Supreme Court justice. And the second thing is that you are no longer deciding things for yourself. You have to decide things in a group, and you may have a brilliant suggestion, but if it cannot garner at least one other vote on a division of the Court of Appeals, or at least four other votes on the Supreme Court, it will be a concurrence or dissent that perhaps nobody reads. And so that's a very important thing to take into consideration. But I think the most important thing about being a good appellate judge is being a good colleague. Your colleagues can make your life very pleasant, or they can make your life very miserable. I think you try to be a good colleague and exercise the golden rule. I always had a practice that when an opinion came in from one of my colleagues, I laid down what I was working on of my own stuff and tried to review their opinion as quickly as possible so that I could get back to them with comments, because I wanted to help them move their business along and not be selfish about just trying to move mine. I think being a good, courteous, considerate colleague makes life much, much easier when you live on a court where you're going to have to live with your colleagues probably for a very long time, and you're going to have to get their votes to decide anything.
Makes a lot of sense. Justice, thank you again for speaking with us. Thank you for your continued service on the advisory board of the Federal Society's Atlanta chapter. We look forward to continuing to work with you. We wish you all the best in private practice. And for those that are still on the line, we will be discussing future meetings coming up via email as we continue to operate in this environment. We will look forward to seeing everyone again in person, hopefully soon. But in the meantime, we will have some more virtual programming. Thank you again, Justice. Thanks for all who participated. Thanks to the Federal Society and Jenny for helping us get this organized together today. Appreciate it.
Thank you.